Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Here's a book title that immediately arrested my attention. Unapologetic, Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. It's a blunt defence of Christian faith, bit of a kickback against the so-called new atheists. I suspect Francis Spufford will get us thinking about religion in a whole new light, and probably ruffle a few feathers along the way. Francis takes on atheists, Richard Dawkins and all that, analysing all the bust-ups over religion. But most of all, he wants peace, productive talk, and a mutual respect between Christian people and atheists. Yes, it can happen. Francis Spufford, welcome to Open House.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Can I start with the perhaps touchy thing first of how this all started? It was a bad row with your wife.
It was. I think lots of people find different threads that lead them to the point of realizing that the mess they're in is not one that they're capable of sorting out with any amount of self-help. And yes, in my case, it was the classic marital mess-up that was my fault, and which left me with a sense that the more honest I was with myself, the fewer places there were to go. And into that came my first hint of a mercy, of something to hold on to, which didn't depend on my effort or on what I deserved. And since in the book I'm trying to make a kind of emotional sense of Christianity by telling it as a story, as a set of emotions in succession, by which religion turns out to be, in my opinion, this kind of tough-minded, realistic adult thing, the thing you feel once the scales have dropped from your eyes.
Yes, how was it then that you connected the lessons you learnt in that row with your wife to questions regarding religion and how that plays out in our world today?
At the time, I was sitting in a cafe miserably drinking a cappuccino because I didn't have to go to work because I was a writer and, you know, how lazy we are. And somebody put on Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, the slow movement, and it is this beautifully patient piece of music, and I could just hear in it reporting by Mr. Mozart of a universe in which there was mercy available. And I found, talking to other people, that things like that seem to happen quite a lot, that there are trails to be read lying around the place. And what I do is I talk about the way that, contrary to Christianity's public image as this kind of rather pretty perfectionist thing, that it is built on the recognition of human frailty and messing up.
Yes.
It even has, as I read it, an ethical code which more or less guarantees that we'll all fail some of the time in some way or other, and that we're supposed to look at each other in due humility, not as spiritual achievers, but on the contrary, as classic underachievers who therefore ought to stick together and be nicer to each other.
Or with judgment and condemnation and even arrogance.
Least of all those things. I found that the Leonard Cohen song Anthem about there being a crack in everything, which I know he didn't at all mean as a piece of Christian theology, seemed actually very accurate to me about the way that, you know, if you're a grown-up Christian who's had a few life experiences, you look at the world and you find it fairly patched and battered and put together again with duct tape in some ways, but nevertheless manageable, and that the faith is part of what makes it manageable. It's part of what gives you bits of faith, hope and charity that you don't have to earn yourself, free and gratis. Grace is extremely important to me, and what I mainly see it is there being kind of more than we deserve, thank God. I mean that literally.
Yes, yes. So if we're in this world that is broken, we have a need for mercy, a need for redemption. How do you view atheism and what it says about life and faith? Because at the end of the day, that is also an exercise of faith, atheism.
It is. I mean, this is the thing that I find maddening in some ways about the new and aggressive atheism, about the kind of atheist who thinks that their opinion of God's absence follows naturally from science itself, which I think is dodgy logic and dodgy philosophy too. I don't have a fundamental problem with atheism. I've never had, and I was one myself for ages. I know what it feels like. And I don't have any problem with respecting people who have a conscientious conviction of God's absence. Lord knows there are long enough stretches of human experience in which that makes perfect sense to me. What does get me a little worked up is the assumption that that ought to be the natural, default, rational, scientific position. I think that Christians and atheists should respect each other as people who, at opposite ends of the scale, are gripped by two convictions that neither lot of us can prove about God being there or God not being there. I think that atheists are wildly romantic creatures holding to a position for which there is no evidence. And as we hold to the position for which we only have the kind of the evidence of the heart ourselves, we ought to be able to kind of wave at atheists on their distant mountain and go, kind of, how's it going over there? But it would be, you know, kind of nice at the same time if, and most atheists do this, if atheists would see Christians as people not engaging in some daft, childish self-deception, but as people who, through the thickets and complicated pathways of the world, have found something to hold on to which makes sense to us. It would be nice if they could see us as people who, dealing with the same uncertainties as them, have found something that we have our own good reasons for holding on to.
The thought-provoking and provocative conclusion that you come to with Christianity and atheism is that neither can be proved.
I do think this. I am basically unpersuaded by any of the arguments for the existence of God. None of them seem to me to go all the way. None of them seem to hold water if you look at them with your skepticism on full beam, which we're supposed to do as adults. But I don't think that's the end of the story. For one thing, it all depends what you mean by evidence. If we're being strictly scientific about it and saying things you can't repeat under laboratory conditions aren't evidence, then we have no evidence at all. But what we do have are all of the experiences we have as Christians, all of the things we can tell each other, all of the note comparing we can do, all of the evidence of the kind of people which we seem to manage to be against the odds. That's not nothing.
So it might not be able to be proved, but it doesn't deny good evidence. Documentary evidence, experiential, historical.
Absolutely not. It's not that I think that, you know, we're kind of floating free in midair with no history, with none of the testimony of other Christians at all. It's that I think ultimately logic is not what we're standing on, and that in the end faith takes us the rest of the way.
One of your overarching desires is for that sense of peace, respect and productive talk that is mutual between Christian people and atheists. How do you view the way each side has debated, argued, and considered these questions, especially in the current climate of the new atheism?
We fundamentally talk past each other. A lot of the kind of heat and air and wrath on the atheist side is based on not horrified acquaintance with religion, but with the forgetting of religion, with being really far away from it in terms of human probabilities. When I look at a book like Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, I don't think its success is the cause of hostility to religion. I think that its success is the expression of that, and that people wouldn't take it so seriously if they could give it the reality check of comparing it to what religion feels like, which is one reason why the emphasis in my book is on trying to show people who haven't lived on the inside of Christianity what kind of world of feelings it is, simply as a kind of a little virtual tour for them. On the Christian side, I think that we haven't always been very good at finding ways to step outside the magic circle of our own assumptions, finding ways to describe enough from the beginning what on earth it is we're talking about. Our vocabulary is a problem these days. I've got to kind of arm wrestle against the associations of the word sin and end up replacing it with a kind of nonsense word of my own devising, just because it isn't covered with these terrible associations with ice cream eating and chocolate and lingerie and frothy self-indulgence, which is what far too many people think of when you say the word sin. And it seems to me you have to start a lot further back than most conventional Christian apologetics does. You don't just have to explain what the words are and what we mean by the words. You've got to explain how that lines up with the basic situations of adult life. You've got to say, you know, that excited feeling, that desperate feeling, that thoughtful feeling, that rueful feeling, that defeated by life feeling, and so on. That's what our story is made of. The thing we tell about the world is not this weird gizmo of ancient words. It's actually this realistic, hard-won thing that make sense of the big murkiness at the centre of everybody's lives.
I suspect we'd probably do better on the Christian side if we heeded Jesus' words of both love God and love your neighbour as yourself. So if we're truly loving our neighbour as ourself, we'll be as concerned to connect with them at a reasonable level and do everything we can to be understanding of them and to make ourselves understood.
I absolutely agree. But as with many of Jesus' bits of advice, it's true, and you have to work out what it means for yourself bit by bit. How you love your neighbour is always a fascinatingly open question, full of very, very tricky calculations sometimes about whether that means, you know, you do what you think is right for them, or you do what you think they want you to do.
It's probably part of the genius of Jesus that it covers so much then.
Absolutely. Yes. People have been carrying it into 2,000 years of extremely different situations by now and finding it useful but challenging every time. Yes, I absolutely agree. And the emphasis in this case needs to be on working hard enough at imagining what it's like being other people who don't necessarily share the language and the self-understanding that people on the inside of faith find naturally. And I don't just mean because this makes for successful evangelism. I mean it's worth doing in itself, that part of loving your neighbour ought to be being curious about your neighbour and respectful of your neighbour and willing to stop and find out what's going on their terms as well.
Can I ask you then, what difference do you say Jesus Christ makes to the consideration of different religions, that here we have the Christian claim that this is God as one of us, living as one of us?
What he is one of is humans, which is all of us. And for me, the very definition of grace is that it does not respect the cautious, overtight little limits of our human sense of justice, our human sense of what we can afford. You know, I'm a Christian. I'm not the kind of multi-faith person who goes, you know, in a very real sense, I think we're all after the same thing. But at the same time, I think it would be mean-spirited of us and far less generous than we are constantly being incited to be by our God. It would be soft-headed of us not to hold to our theological convictions and our sense that Christianity is central, and it would be arrogant of us and unchristian in a more profound sense if we didn't allow for the possibility that God is doing stuff we don't get to see.
But there is a difference between being offered that grace of Jesus Christ and embracing it and taking it on for ourselves.
I agree, but I cannot say I know exactly what form that offer and that acceptance will always take. And we can all instinctively see that there is something wrong with the kind of pre-modern theology that goes, everyone who hasn't had the good luck to receive an evangelist is going straight to hell. And I think we need to apply the same kind of caution, the same sense that God's omnipotence exceeds our rules and our legalities in this case too. But I am not building some cozy, cuddly kind of structure here in which religious differences don't matter. I think they matter considerably. I think Christianity is more true than the other religions because I think it reaches to something central to God's intentions. I don't believe that we are under a kind of obligation to be shapelessly nice in which we don't go, no, we think you got that wrong.
And despite all the dogged debates and expressions of faith, you say you've never met a Christian who didn't recognise the experience of finding God absent.
That's true. Sometimes, as you know, we can be dressed in armour for public purposes, and then it would be very tempting to deny that God had ever failed to be there just where you were expecting to find him. On the other hand, if people are relaxed enough to be speaking the truth of the heart in all its complications, then no. I have never talked to any Christian who hadn't at times had the experience of looking for him and failing to find him, of looking at the world and finding that it looks like a pretty unredeemed place, looking at the pain and suffering that comes as standard with human life and doesn't say, can't make sense of that. I'm sorry, at this moment, the religious formulas which have comforted me so much at other times appear at this point to be ecclesiastical blah, mealy hollow words. And my experience is that the words refill with meaning and consolation at other times, but you've got to be honest about
Could I ask you a personal question to conclude our conversation? So you've dealt with this at a largely theoretical, theological level. Can I ask you personally, what makes you believe in a God you cannot see?
Because he feels as if he's there, because I needed him and he was, because I needed to be forgiven and I felt I was, because I eat the bread and drink the wine and feel myself joined to him every Sunday morning.
Does the history inform much of that, the history of the Christian?
It does. I come from a church which takes its history seriously. I'm in the Church of England, and the sense is of not just of one timeless revelation, but of the Holy Spirit blowing on through human history, working its purposes out, with us turning new things up towards the light and discovering new bits of God's intention towards us in the consciences of men and women of good faith. Sometimes the history is a problem. Christian history is in many ways a bloodstained and problematic history, and I think we need to distinguish between God's good intentions and the frequently wandering intentions of Christians. We are only human, and sometimes we mess up. We don't pass through a one-way door into virtue when we accept redemption. We continue to need it. We continue to mess up. It's a challenge, but then what isn't if you look at it straight on and as honestly as you can?
Which is at the heart of this very question, to be honest about the evidence and the experience. Francis Buffett, it's been a mind-expanding and most thought-provoking discussion. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
You're very welcome.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.